to date has been mixed. Some nearby residents support the digging line options. There has been one resident who would prefer the plasma torch option, but would like that option to occur off-site. And then the city prefers a permanent remedy, whether that be plasma torch or digging truck. Mm-hmm. In other words, moving the waste to another location. And when I say permanent remedy, that is not necessarily a permanent remedy for the waste, but it's a permanent remedy maybe for the landfill. Mm-hmm. I think a big part of the question, I'm going to question four here, and that is that where has plasma torch technology been used, and for what kinds of waste? And we have spent a significant amount of time trying to track down information on that subject. And on the back side of the handout that was provided to you, there's a table that identifies various uses of plasma torch technologies to address different kinds of waste. And if you look at the table, you notice the table at the top. In the columns are identified as location type, the type of waste, and then the amount of waste that goes through, that's in tons per day, as well as activation dates. And then there's some, we try to provide sources as well as where this information came from. I want to say right off the bat that this was not necessarily an exhaustive search, but it was certainly, we did our best, and we had a difficult time finding good information that was available, either on the internet or in any other venue. You'll notice that in the facility location column, use of plasma technology has been employed in Japan, and there has been a little bit of use at other kinds of facilities, but you'll notice that the type of waste that this technology is used for has mostly been for used for materials that are expensive or difficult to landfill, and that includes incinerator ash, hazardous waste, or medical waste. We found very few instances where MSW, or municipal solid waste, was being used as the fuel, if you will. So that made it kind of difficult in our comparison of using of plasma torch technology. There's little information available. You'll notice at the bottom of that table that there are four operations that are currently using MSW, very small quantities, and sometimes they're using that as a mix. In other words, they are actually augmenting another waste with MSW, and this is fresh MSW, this is not old waste. Sometimes they use the fresh MSW and they augment it with other waste as well. But in any case, it's small quantities. The proposal the alternative that our consultant looked at for use of plasma torch technology was looking at 2,000 tons a day. And so these are, it's just orders of magnitude different. The scale is quite a bit different. We did find one instance where there is a proposal to use this technology on a combination of old and fresh MSW. But it's been in the proposal stages, and it's unclear when that would be built. And that's in Florida. Mm-hmm. So, I guess in summary on the table, there's little information that we can work off of with regard to using this technology at the Washington County landfill. Mm-hmm. Moving on to question five, what is the feasibility of plasma torch gasification at the Washington County landfill? As I mentioned before, that in the alternative we reviewed, or our consultant reviewed, looked at a 2,000 ton per day throughput through the facility to handle 2.5 million yards of old municipal waste. That waste is, some of it is located in water. It's wet, it's not just old municipal waste, it also contains soil, making it much more difficult to work with. We're not saying it couldn't. We don't know if it could be, but since it hasn't been used before, but we know it would likely be harder, and the energy cost would be very, very significant. The FDH report indicated $137 million would be necessary to use that technology to address the NSW.
Mm-hmm.
It is really unknown at this time whether air emissions would be an issue with this kind of technology for NSW. We believe, however, that plasma torch technology does hold potential for reducing or eliminating fresh NSW in the future. Unfortunately, the technology has not yet been proven for the use for old NSW. The sixth question that was asked...
Before you continue, mm-hmm. I want to ask, and maybe other members have as well, a few clarifying questions or comments about this one.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding was that the 2,000 tons per day rate, not mixing it with any other waste, it would take 3.5 years to incinerate the waste.
That is correct.
So if you mixed it, it would take, assuming the same size of torch, it would take, let's say if you had mixed it half new, half old waste, it would take 7 years to extract it. And then, of course, there'd be the issue of the continuing pollution that would occur during those 7 years you're, you know, gradually pulling it out and incinerating it. It's also the case, I believe, that your figure of the cost of this for that landfill assumed only using it for that one landfill, and that was the end of the life of the plasma torch afterwards. And I would challenge that assumption that I think that this option is really not an option unless you can tell me why the plasma torch is dead at the end of the 3.5 year process and no longer functioning. That really it's an option that has to be evaluated technically and financially in the light of a, you know, multiple use over time, you know, to assist in the removal of multiple landfills, and that any one project evaluation like that doesn't convey what the cost of this option is. Would that be a correct statement?
Madam Chair, I would agree.
Okay.
And again, this is a conceptual.
Right.
Very.
Well, it's very important because if you're comparing the $23 million of, you know, the dig and, dig up and rebury with a liner to the almost $200 million for a plasma torch, that's not the right comparison. It would be a different kind of comparison using this technology to take care of multiple sites somewhere.
Madam Chair, committee, I would also mention, however, that mm-hmm. if you wanted to blend this waste with other waste, mm-hmm. the question comes up, where would you do this?
Yeah.
And that presents some other issues.
And my understanding, the other issues it presents, first of all, you would have to be trucking it somewhere still, which would require cost, from all those other locations to some central location where you have the torch, and then you'd have multiple permitting issues with some new location. And then as you mentioned air emissions, but I also have heard there's some sludge produced from this as well. There's even a wet emissions with the torch. So I'm not sure anybody fully understands the environmental negative outputs from the torch technology yet that would have to be taken into consideration.
That's correct. And in addition, there may be issues associated with finding fresh waste that would be available,
yeah.
because some of that waste is already spoken for
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
in contracts.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Go ahead.
Continuing on, in question six, has the MPCA spoken to any vendors of plasma torch technology? My closed landfill program engineer spoke to two vendors, one from StarTech
mm-hmm.
and one from Phoenix Solutions. And some of the information that we included or presented in the table came from those individuals who spoke of specific facilities where their equipment was being used.
Mm-hmm.
When we did speak with them, they asked the question if they were aware of use of this technology for old MSW, and at least with one individual, they were not aware, but they thought it was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So
Was either of those vendors involved in the Florida proposed study, which was doing a large quantity?
Actually not. Apparently that is being supplied by, would be supplied by Westinghouse.
Oh.
And move on to the seventh question. Is the community supporting plasma gasification? The Lake Elmo City Council seems to prefer a permanent option, whether that is digging trucks or using the plasma torch approach. However, you know, again, it is unclear whether or not the City Council would support the plasma option if that was going to be employed on site.
I just want to make a point for clarification for the audience and maybe some of the other legislative members as well, that this site, while it's in the north, roughly northwestern corner of Lake Elmo, it's the site that is leading to the pollution not only south of that in Lake Elmo, but also the whole northern part of Woodbury. The PFBA and PFC pollution in the northern part of Woodbury is from this site. So it's important to all our communities, and I know that the mayor of Woodbury and the city minister of Woodbury were at, and also the mayor of Lake Elmo were at the Senate hearing last night on this topic. So it's very important to the Woodbury community as well.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, committee, I would point out that we don't disagree that the Washington County Landfill is a source of the PFBA contamination that is moving south. However, it's unclear at this time whether or not we are the only source of the contamination, that there's a, also the Oakdale site. Finally, on question number 8, what is the timeline going forward? There is a official public comment period that is going to begin on February 14th.
Mm-hmm.
We've been holding these preliminary sessions to provide information to folks. We understand this is a very difficult situation to understand, and the issues are very important to people, mm-hmm. so we've tried to give them that opportunity mm-hmm. to get that information. But we will start the public comment period on the 14th of February. We will be holding a public meeting on the 21st of February. I believe it's at the Oakdale Junior High School in Lake Elmo. And then the public comment period is scheduled to end on March 15th.
Mm-hmm.
The MPCA commissioner will be making a final decision following that public comment period. And whatever the option is that is chosen, we can only move forward if there's funding available. And if that funding is available, we would anticipate completing a design, whatever that alternative is, and beginning construction work either in late 2008 or early 2009.
Mm-hmm. Again, to put some of this in context, and maybe Mr. Day, I don't know if you have the answer to this, but if you could tell everyone in the room, first of all, how many sites are under the closed landfill program, how many have been cleaned up of those, and what has been spent on that in total so far, and therefore what the average expense has been on those sites. I think I know the numbers, if you don't, but maybe one of you can say it. So. But.
Well, the closed landfill program has 112 qualified facilities. There are currently 109 facilities that are mm-hmm. in our program that we are responsible for. When I mean responsible, we are responsible for monitoring and for cleanup and long-term care. We have spent to date, and again, maybe you can correct me on this, I think $260 million, some of that in that price range, for cleanup operations, for reimbursement to folks who have done work under Superfund in the past, for payment for insurance recovery efforts. But most of that work, most of those dollars were spent on actual cleanup and monitoring of the site.
Okay. Does someone else want to comment on that one, too? I'm seeing the people behind you kind of back and forth with each other. I ask this because it's my understanding that this particular site cleanup is much higher than any previous one. And I wanted the people to understand the magnitude that we were talking about here in relative to what has been done at other places.
That is correct, Chair. Madam Chair. And there are currently, we understand that there are 14 sites that still need construction work accomplished at them.
Mm-hmm.
The costs involved with that are in the neighborhood of $90 million.
Mm-hmm. That includes this one, or, sorry?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Okay, so subtracting the 23 you're proposing for this one, the rest of that is over the other 13. Is what
that's correct. And recognizing that this site, up to $8 million would be available for use as part of the consent decree with 3M.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, but the number I'd heard recently was, you know, in the most of these sites that have been constructions have been in like the $2-3 million range in the past.
And sure, that is correct. Okay. We have a few sites that larger sites that are costing us more, but on average, $1-2 million would be correct.
And is this site among the larger sites?
This site currently is the largest site we have in our program in terms of costs we've identified.
Is that large by volume, by area, by types of waste?
The Washington County landfill is one of our top 10 or 12 landfills in terms of volume, but in terms of the cost involved, this would be right up there at the top or near the top.
Okay. And I know that Senator Salzman has arrived, but I know she knows this topic quite well. To see or anyone else have any further question on this portion on the Washington County closed landfill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that some of the struggles that are going on right now are because you've had this list of sites and that the Washington County site has in the past year popped up to number two. And any comments on that to help us understand what has caused this to go to number two? I think we all know why, but just for the record to indicate that would be very helpful. Because I think that's the challenge, is that we do have this remaining list of 14 sites and why this site has now been brought to the top of the list.
And Chair, Senator Saltzman, committee, that is correct. This site is number two on our classification list right now. And the reason for that is because of the PFC contamination which we have identified that at the landfill and that has spread, and the fact that we are having to supply a number of residents with alternative water,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that we are impacting drinking water supplies, that's very serious, and that's reflected in our classification system that we believe needs immediate attention. The fact that we are also degrading an aquifer, and the fact that material is, we currently don't have the means to address it.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to add that this site is unlike any other, and the fact that it has this PFC contamination in it, and we have, in our experience in cleaning up landfills, this site is completely different in how you can address it. It doesn't react like the rest of the landfills we've had to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Just another question, Madam Chair. Is that one of the questions that I asked of your staff earlier this week was, is that the $15 million is certainly a significant amount, and that I discussed, would it be possible to spread this over several years? That, you know, with some projects that the state does, we can fund part of it. And the explanation was that when you bid this, you need all the money. That this particular site, even though the construction may be over several years, you need the money up front. Could you just confirm that for the record? State your name.
My name is Jeff Lewis. I actually manage the closed landfill program. We had that discussion earlier this week, and yes, the way the contracting systems are set up for the state, we actually have to have that money either in hand or assured in a fund that we have access to before we can let a contract. this type of construction project that we have at this site is not something that we could divide into phases, because we basically have to pick up the waste, construct the liner, and then put it back. And so there wouldn't be any way to divide it into separate projects where we could bid it out as smaller increments.
One final clarification on those same lines that Mr. Falcon was pursuing initially. The other landfills on this list of 14, are any of them known to have currently water pollution to aquifers associated with them? I mean, you were focusing on the PFC issue being unique, but is there, you know, public health threat and or water pollution occurring currently from the other sites, or are they just known to be needing attention in general?
Madam Chair, all 14 that are left on our list for work to be done have current groundwater contamination issues associated with them. None of them are impacting drinking water aquifers to the extent that this site is. And basically our rating system is based on one of the key criteria is impacting of either public or private water supplies. There was one other site that currently has some impacts going on to private wells. That was our Mille Lacs site. It's a small site that we need to do some work on. We just learned about the contamination issues late last fall. And because of that, we're actually proposing to address the cleanup of that site using some insurance recovery monies we have within the remediation fund. So we'll probably be dropping that off of our list as a project. We'll move forward on that. The cleanup of that is a small dollar amount.
Okay. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to say, as someone who's worked in solid waste, that the CLP program has allowed us to clean up a lot of these sites faster and at lower cost than if they were just left alone and ended up in the Superfund program, and that was one of the reasons that it was set up the way it was. But I was just going to comment that the revenue that the state collects to clean up sites like this has, other than bonding, has been from the solid waste management tax, which is charged on your garbage bill, and only 70% of the solid waste management tax actually goes to the environmental fund, and 30% just stays in the general fund. And if you'd just like to know, I just put a bill in the hopper to dedicate all of it. I don't know what luck I'll have with the deficit going on, but I just thought I would let you know.
Well, Representative Gardner, I'm glad you raised that, because that the issue of that those fees have been used to fund the closed landfill program raised the issue of why we're now bonding for this. And has bonding requests for these landfills occurred before, or is it because the magnitude of this one is unique and there are not adequate funds through this traditional means to do it?
Madam Chair, committee, we have three funding sources which we've used for our program historically. The bonding is one. The second source of funding is the solid waste tax. The third source of funding that Mr. Lewis alluded to was the insurance recovery effort. We've also received a small amount of money, funds from financial assurance accounts which were closed and transferred to the state when the sites entered the program. When the legislation was passed in 1994, when the funding discussions occurred, it was considered to be like a three-legged stool. They looked at three different funding sources to fund this program. And it was assumed that bonding would be used, can only be used for capital improvements, and so could only be used for construction activities at these landfills. And we've used the other sources of funding to cover the monitoring and things of that, reimbursements and things of that nature. And so to date, we've received a little over $80 million in bonding.
Did you want to make any final comments? No? Thank you, Mr. Day. Thank you, Mr. Lewis. And is your...
If I might. I just want to thank the MPCA, because over the last few weeks, we've called on you a lot to answer questions, and you've always been very responsive, and I just want to thank you for that with your help earlier this week when I had several questions as we try to work on answering concerns relating on the responding request. And so I really just want to express to you that I appreciate the very quick turnaround on those questions. So,
you're welcome.
Thank you.
And for the very brief report on the water, fish, lake testing and fishes, the most recent update, but we do want to keep this portion very short because we have. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Hoff. I'm the supervisor of the Environmental Reporting and Special Studies Unit, which was working on fish testing as a follow-up to the discovery in Lake Calhoun last year of surprisingly elevated levels of PFOS, one of the contaminants. And just last week, I think most of you should have received a phone call from us to alert you that we had some results in and thought it was time to share from our urban lake survey. Mm-hmm. And so that information was posted on our website and for interested news media who've been following the issue. We're almost finished with this urban lake study. There were quite a number of lakes in all in the metro area. A couple are still out there with fish at the lab. It's not entirely complete, but we had enough. And a number of these lakes were either in your districts or adjacent to them, and we wanted you to know about that. Mm-hmm. In this particular round, mostly lakes. It went in several batches, but the first batch was reported in August, and that focused mostly on east side lakes. Mm-hmm. There were a few of those in your districts this time to kind of help fill out the data set and also to see what was going on in the western suburbs and in some of the other adjacent lakes in Minneapolis. And I realize you're in a hurry today, so I just wanted to let you know that if you have any questions about particular lakes in your district, we'd be very happy to help follow up on that. In general, the overall assessment of where we are and the importance of doing this is not only to just find where fish may be showing signs of PFOS, but almost more importantly, why is that and where is it coming from and what can we do to stop that and to drive those numbers down when we eventually go back to test in them. And I think one of the things we have learned so far is that through this work, that we don't see a broad uniformity in fish tissue concentration around the lakes in the metro area, and that indicates to us that airborne deposition is not likely a significant contributor to the handful of lakes that are higher than others. And for those handful, which is really four, Lake Elmo, Jarvis on the east side, Calhoun, and then Johanna now that are elevated enough, we're going to be going back for more intensive studies of those watersheds to try to find out what's going on and what sort of source is contributing to those levels. Mm-hmm. So with that, I'll stop and take any questions. And if this is not the best time, I'm always available at another time for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very briefly, I understand that there's a fish alert, but that swimming in the water is not going to be any kind of an issue. Is that true?
That is the advice that the health department gave with the Lake Calhoun findings last year, and I would guess that the advice would be the same. That's the correct answer. Mm-hmm. Looking at Mr. Stein, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. We're now going to turn to presentation from 3M, Mr. Hohenstein. 3M has three disposal areas in the East Metro, and we'll let him describe what the three are and the plans, options presented for each of three of us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. On behalf of 3M, I'd like to express our appreciation for this opportunity to provide you with just that sort of update on the progress we're making towards additional remediation activities at each of our sites. And before I actually begin, by way of further introduction, again, my name is Gary Hohenstein. I'm a manager in 3M's Corporate Environmental Health Safety organization. And my current responsibilities involve a variety of activities pertaining to the fluorochemicals. More specifically, and relative to today's agenda, I'm the project manager. I'm the primary contact under the agreement that was finalized last May with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We know that some of you here have attended one or more of our recent public meetings that 3M has hosted to gather input on our project. And those of you that have attended know that we've prepared 30 to 45 minutes of formal presentation for each one of those sites. And, of course, our understanding of the topic for today is not nearly that level of detail. So we've provided we've prepared a synopsis of the three sites and the public meetings. We also understand that there is some interest in hearing about the feedback that we received from the public at each of those meetings. So, with that in mind, we've come prepared. You, I believe, have the handout, the page and a half handout that summarizes each of the three sites, and we'll walk through that, use that as a guide for our discussion here today. As each of you probably know, 3M was very actively engaged with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in conducting environmental assessments at our Oakdale disposal site, at our Woodbury disposal site, and at the 3M Cottage Grove manufacturing facility with the MPCA back in May when the agreement was put in place. As a result of that, because we were, in a sense, midstream, we were able to incorporate into that agreement very specific identification of where we were at in the stage, and our exhibits that became a part of that agreement recognized the fact that progress was already underway at each one of those sites. The other thing that the agreement really did was it formalized the process going forward. It incorporated a very mature, a very well-established set of guidance that EPA and states like Minnesota have used to address cleanup sites like the three that we're dealing with here. So it formalized, in a sense, what we were already working on. In essence, to date, we've been working really hard on two key aspects relative to that specifically mapped out process that I just mentioned. And these two aspects are known as remedial investigations and feasibility studies. In short, the first thing that one needs to do at any site before even thinking about response actions is to understand the site, to characterize the site. And this is exactly what a remedial investigation does. So what constituents are present, in what media, at what levels, what exposure routes might exist, all of that goes into a remedial investigation. And it's really critical that the right data and the right information be obtained in order that good decisions be made relative to response actions. Furthermore, in general, a lot of effort needs to go into remedial investigations, and they can take a considerable amount of time because of that. We're pleased to be here today and able to tell you that we have invested a great deal of effort in our remedial investigations at each of the three sites, and that we have essentially completed that work. That aspect of in this process has been completed. And again, it was a summary of that work that we presented to the public via posters and our formal presentations at each of the three meetings. So with a good understanding and characterization of the site in hand, the next step in this very detailed, very well-established process is to evaluate the options or the alternatives to deal with the constituents that have been found to be present. And this is what's referred to as a feasibility study, ultimately leading up to a feasibility study report. And this is essentially the stage that we're at today. In fact, more specifically, and this is based on the timeline that was incorporated into the settlement agreement, the Oakdale feasibility study report was submitted to the MPCA a week ago. The Woodbury report will be submitted. It will go in week after next. And the Cottage Grove report is due in mid-March. Once these are submitted, the reports are reviewed by MPCA staff, and they ultimately become a part of the input that staff and ultimately is the commissioner's decision to select a final response action. So this is key input for the agency, for agency staff. With all of this as a backdrop, perhaps we can now turn to the handout that we've prepared and go through more specifics relative to our site. And with Oakville as an example, and again, you will notice some parallel framework to the other sites, you'll see three basic parts to the 3M recommendation, and we'll walk through each one. As noted under the first bullet, we see a need for and we are recommending institutional controls. And these are quite straightforward. They're pretty common. They're pretty typical. You see listed under the bullet the types of things that fit this category: deed restrictions, site security, groundwater monitoring, or monitoring in general, those types of things. So pretty straightforward, pretty common for these types of efforts. The second part, highlighted under the second bullet for each of the three sites, is a key. And it's what we term more broadly as site groundwater management. We believe that in conjunction with the prior and very significant cleanup activities that have taken place at these sites, that enhanced groundwater management, as we have outlined it, is really the linchpin to our overall approach for each site. There's two key important components to groundwater management when we talk about it. The first is ensuring that impacted groundwaters at the site are contained, that they're captured. And the second involves the treatment of whatever water is extracted or pumped at the site. For Oakdale, while we have had an extraction well network for some period of time, many decades actually, one result from our remedial investigation was that we need to enhance that. We need to add additional extraction wells. And beyond that, we are recommending a treatment system for the water that is pumped from the ground. This is also conceptually, this is also what we're dealing with at our Cottage Grove site. In other words, there are wells already extracting groundwater. They don't totally contain impacted areas. Mm-hmm. And so we are recommending additional pump out wells, extraction wells for the Cottage Grove site, in addition to a treatment system. For Woodbury, the situation is slightly different in that we feel, and we have documented, complete capture of groundwaters at that site, and so the recommendation is a treatment system for the Woodbury waters. Mm-hmm. The third basic component to each of our recommendations involves management of impacted soils. And the way we've laid out this piece merits some additional discussion and explanation. In short, and again using Oakdale as an example, relative to soils, we present three alternatives, and we can discuss kind of the differences between those if you would like. But the bottom line is that we believe that each one of the three is equally protective, and that ultimately we will leave the choice amongst these three alternatives to the MPCA. Now, questions probably immediately come to mind. For example, what do we mean when we say that we view each of these alternatives as equally protective? This really goes back to our strong belief that the groundwater management technologies are the real workhorse, or the real safety net at these sites. In other words, at Oakdale, the impacted soils that we've identified lie north of Highway 5. And water that has percolated through those soils has been captured by the existing groundwater extraction system, and this will continue on into the future. From this standpoint, the amount of soils that we ultimately remove north of Highway 5 bear really more on the time by which we might operate that groundwater extraction and treatment system. It really isn't impacting off-site migration. Okay, so you might also ask, and we received this question at our public meetings, as we presented three alternatives, as presented by the three bullets under Oakdale, this is pretty simple. pretty basic. Why wouldn't you just do the most aggressive, the most extensive option? And the answer to that question is, we can, and we might. But what needs to be understood is that the question isn't quite as simple as it sounds. The reality is that there are pros and cons to every alternative, and this is why EPA long ago adopted the criteria that Mr. Day alluded to earlier in order that evaluations could be conducted for alternatives that come forward. On the handout, the last item under Oakdale, the last sentence there, it spells out the criteria that MPCA will be using in their decision on the final remediation approach at each one of our sites. And this is, again, directly from our agreement with the MPCA. So we've already mentioned, back to the specifics of Oakdale, we've already mentioned that one of the pros is that the more soil we would take out north of Highway 5, perhaps the shorter the time period by which we would have to operate our containment system, our pump-out and treatment system. There are also some cons. There are some disadvantages to greater and greater amounts of soil that are removed, and those simply need to be considered. Each one of our projects will be a major construction effort, and there will be heavy equipment, and there will be heavy trucks, and there will be a lot of trucks involved. And so the greater the magnitude of that effort, it's very straightforward, the greater the risk relative to a major construction project. Perhaps of even greater importance, certainly to the neighborhood and to the community more broadly, are that there will be other impacts to this work. There will be traffic. There will be noise. There will be dust. There may be odors. There will be vehicle emissions. Just in general, there will be disruptions as this project is executed, and the amount of time that takes varies depending on the alternative. So all of those are factors that simply need to be considered in the overall evaluation. In summary, I guess when it comes to the soil options specifically, our perspective is that they are all equally protective of human health and the environment, that there are pros and cons to each one of them, and that the MPCA will appropriately make the final determination. At this point, I've used Oakdale somewhat as the example to summarize our overall approach at the site. Again, part of that's because we're furthest along with the Oakdale. We have submitted that FS feasibility study report. If you'd like, I can go through the specifics as outlined under the Woodbury and the Cottage Grove location, or if you'd prefer, for the sake of time, we could shift gears and talk about the feedback that we received at the public meeting. I would leave that up to you.
I have a general question, and that's in all three of these instances, when you use the word excavation and then disposal, the word disposal, 0 to 4 feet, are you talking in the same location again? We're redisposing, we're excavating and redisposing at the same site?
Madam Chair,
or removing?
If I understand the question, to clarify, this will involve excavation for each of the three alternatives and disposal off-site.
Off-site, that's what I'm going to clarify. It didn't say off-site or anywhere, so.
Okay. Good clarification,
yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead to the issue of feedback. Sorry. Go ahead.
This may be the question is that oftentimes we think that if something costs more, it's going to be a better job. And are you finding that here, that if one of the proposals that you bring forward happens to cost less, will you be able to sort of justify why it maybe is more effective? Because I think that there's a perception again, and maybe the best way will cost more. But I hope that we don't make a decision just based on cost, because it may be a better solution. Is that where I'm going with that? Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Saltzman, it's an excellent point that you make, that cost, and as listed on the sheet, cost is one, in our case, is one of four criteria, and it should not be the only one. There can, in fact, be better solutions at lower cost based on a weighting and a consideration of all the factors as listed.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Well,
thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hohenstein, I attended the Cottage Grove 3M briefing, and you just stated something that I heard there as well, and that is this disruption to the environment. I believe it was Mr. Gates who talked about that, and that in some ways it would be better, for instance, at the Cottage Grove disposal site, to top off the disposal site with new soil, grade it so that there is runoff of rain and that sort of thing. And it seemed to be the point I felt like 3M was stating, that this is what they consider a superior solution, at least from his perspective. To me, I will be anxious to hear what the summary of public comment is, but earlier in our meeting, as we were discussing this, residents, at least at the Oakdale disposal site, are wanting a permanent disposal. They want a permanent solution. And when we are covering something with more topsoil and grading it for runoff, when it's located right next to the Mississippi River that is prone to flooding and so forth, I need to be able to be convinced that your solution of just adding more soil, covering it, grading it, for me, that I am not a scientist, I'm not a geologist, I don't pretend to understand the intricacies of the science, but I am concerned when I hear that being touted as a more, perhaps a more cost-effective and reasonable solution. I'm not convinced.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Wells, it's an excellent question that you ask, and what we mean to state again is, at the Cottage Grove meeting and for all of these, we are not saying that of the three alternatives, one is better than the other. That's our point, in that they are equally protective. And I think fundamentally this goes to an issue of, you mentioned it, the permanence of the remedy, or the permanence of the alternative or the solution. And I think what we have is choices relative to securing materials in a different place, in a landfill of a secure design, if you will. That's one approach, and that's certainly a part of what our planning involves. There is also, when we know that groundwaters are not escaping from our site, and that we are going to extract that groundwater and treat the constituents that are present, there is a permanence to that, in that those materials are adsorbed. In our situation, we would be using activated carbon for the treatment. The materials would be adsorbed on that carbon and ultimately regenerated or reactivated by vendors who are in the business, and that thermally destroys. So there's a permanence to that aspect of treatment involving groundwater. So both can be in play, and I think this is the balancing that's involved, and this is part of the reason why we've come to the point where we're saying each is equally protective. There are some disadvantages and some advantages to each, and we're prepared to execute any of the three.
I don't know if you were at the Cottage Grove meeting. I know Representative Swales and I both were, and I'd kind of beg to differ. I think that the first option presented by 3M was very detailed, very thorough, very, this is good, and then, oh, here's two and three. So, which, being the first person to get to ask a question that night, my question was, is there a difference in cost? Is there a difference in something? Why you just focus on the first options and kind of were very brief on the second and third. And I think there is significant cost difference between the first, second, and third. At least that's what was kind of stated at the meeting. So, and I'll let you get into the feedback part of it, but what was very apparent there was that people didn't want it on site at Cottage Grove, and there was a concern about the bluff that's there and kind of the natural preservation there, but also along with the runoff from the other contaminated areas, because there are a few different contaminated areas along that cove. So, I mean, I guess I would say that one option was, I mean, all three were touted as very viable and get to the point and get things done, but there were options that were pushed more than the other ones, and I just think that the one clear thing is that it needs to be removed and stored off-site was a very apparent feedback from that meeting. But I'll let you talk about what you guys heard.
Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, I was present at the Cottage Grove meeting, and it was not our intent to be steering the presentation towards this is our favored approach. If that's the way it came across, that was not our intent. Certainly there are cost differences. There's no doubt that there are cost differences. I think that goes to the question asked earlier. Cost is one factor among several others.
The general question, have you identified any off-site locations to take this waste to at this point?
Madam Chair, that was one of the questions I was going to raise that we did in our public meetings as well, and we continue to be in the process of identifying an existing permitted landfill suitable for these types of materials. That effort is still underway.
Mm-hmm. And to your knowledge, are most of these appropriate or permanent landfills ones that are lined landfills, and are they all in Minnesota?
The answer to the first part of your question is yes, these certainly would be lined landfills. We really don't have any geographic boundaries around our search at this point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I would like to, after we kept informed by you or the PCA, appropriate about what options are being looked at for the site as we move forward.
We certainly will do that, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. And on that point, Madam Chair, I think that's important because we may have, you know, colleagues who are coming to us,
mm-hmm.
and as we talk about the permanent solution, mm-hmm. we may have colleagues who are coming to us and asking us questions that we've been asking about these, you know, chemicals. So that's very helpful
mm-hmm.
to kind of know that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to the public meetings, relative to those meetings, we certainly greatly appreciated the opportunities that they represented for good dialogue with interested individuals around the work that we've done and the remedial options that are under consideration. By way of review, at each meeting, we had a one-hour informal time with many posters characterizing our work and our data. We've found that is, for some people, a better forum to approach and have questions or to be able to put comments in front of us. And we, of course, followed that with the 45-minute presentation and then questions and answers. And then following a group question and answer, we remained available at the posters and at the meeting locations for still further dialogue with people. And as you might guess, or certainly as many of you observed, the questions were quite varied and far-ranging. And in general for today, I guess we wanted to highlight or surface some general themes or groupings that we saw to the questions. First, and as frankly as we hoped, because it was the purpose of the meeting, we did have people interested in the investigations that we'd done and the data that we had generated and what it meant and the alternatives that we were putting forward. So we hope, we trust that the completeness of our work and the thoughtfulness of our approaches came through, but others will be the judge of that. Certainly it was the purpose of the meeting. I wouldn't say that there were an overwhelming abundance of specific feedbacks concerning the alternative, but some good dialogue with many people. Secondly, and again, really to be expected, we had many people who had questions about their drinking water, had questions about health studies, had questions about treatment technologies that might be employed for home systems, and knowing that this would be on people's minds, we made our physicians and toxicologists available to help try to answer those questions, to share the information and the knowledge that we have. Another question I was going to highlight was the what are you going to do with the soils? And I think we've covered that one already. So there were many other questions, of course, but these seem to reflect some of the key themes. Again, our chance to share information and ideas is something that we viewed very much as a positive. It's helped us going forward. That would be some of the key things that we observed in the meeting.
Just a comment, I was at the Woodbury meeting, and the way it looks like it may have been laid out a little differently, the options, than at the Oakdale and Cottage Grove, I don't know for sure, but the options kind of built on one another. They were like, you add a little more of this or that to the different options, and in particular, I think it was the general sense I felt from many in the audience, but even the mayor of Woodbury, I don't know if he knew it, the mayor at the time who said it, we want all four. Okay, that was kind of response from the audience, you know, do it all. We want the complete package. Okay, so I just want to repeat that for the record. That was kind of the message I was hearing, and certainly from the public officials locally that were there at that meeting, is that they thought, let's do the whole thing. They weren't mutually exclusive options that were being presented at that one. I don't know about the others.
Madam Chair, we certainly heard that. That was what I was referring to in the earlier question. I think it came up in the earlier question by Representative Bingham.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. The Department of Health. Come on down. And Director Stein, just by way of trying to keep to that 5 o'clock deadline here today, I suggest on the first three bullets that these are all things that, well, at least the first two, they've been released previously in December and in January, and so there has been public notice and articles on this, and other committees have heard them as well. So we have just a very brief summary of update on those for those in the room that have not heard that yet, and a very brief update on the HPV setting process, and we'll spend most of the remaining of our time talking about the biomonitoring program. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Stein with Minnesota Department of Health, Environmental Health Division, and understand your point about brevity. The health risk limit for PFOA, we have proposed a modification in a future rule revision. So what I wanted to report on that is, you may recall that the legislature directed the department to establish health risk limits for PFOA and PFOS, which were done in August of 2007. We set the health risk limits by rule at 0.3 parts per billion for PFOS, 0.5 parts per billion for PFOA. Those are, again, long-term exposure values, considering drinking water is the source. And what we've proposed and published and have put out on our website is a reduction in that number from 0.5 parts per billion for PFOA to 0.3 parts per billion. The basis for doing that would be reevaluation of the appropriate dose factor, the reference dose that we would use, using serum concentrations as opposed to the administered dose concentrations in animal studies. One of the things that we've got in more recent data that become available on animal studies is you usually don't have the data on what is the amount of the chemical within the serum of the animal's blood. Mm-hmm. You only have what was administered in the dose to the animals. More recent studies that have been done help us look at that in a more clear fashion, and the experts in the toxicological field that we've consulted with believe that the more appropriate reference dose is the serum levels. And we've had a lot of discussion about that. That value is not effective. We have not lowered our health risk limit. We are proposing to lower it mm-hmm. when we amend our rules. And so that's the update on that health risk limit for PFOA. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Regarding our water filter study, we have published a couple of fact sheets, one that we handed out early in December, and now the one that we've updated on our website is the one I've provided copies today. About the first phase of the project, we did study a number of point-of-use filter devices. Again, point-of-use filters are at one tap in your home. So this would typically be your kitchen sink tap, and we evaluated a number of different filter methodologies and technologies and found a number of them to be effective at eliminating PFCs from the drinking water at that tap. The others, there were some that were not effective, and there are additional studies being done of those to see what we may learn, because we challenge these filters at a fairly high rate of flow, as well as concentration of the compounds in the water. So we're going back and doing some additional testing at lower concentrations and at lower rates of flow to see what we can learn about sort of that continuum of effectiveness of the treatment. But certainly at the high rate of flow and at the concentrations against which the filters were challenged, we did have successful treatment on a number of the systems, largely from the filters that use reverse osmosis technology. And some of those reverse osmosis technologies are generally combined with pre- and post-treatment filters using activated carbon. So that information has been made available to the public. We answer a number of questions from residents seeking advice and seeking to understand what water filtration devices are in their home, how they compare to the ones that are on our studies, and we do consult with a number of community members daily about those questions. So that's been very helpful to have that study in the state it's been completed. We are now analyzing water from the two pump houses that we plan to utilize, the one in St. Paul Park, which only was contaminated with PFBA at somewhere around 2 parts per billion, and then the Oakdale pump house for well number 5 that has concentrations of PFOA, PFOS, and PFBA. So we're again going back and looking at effectiveness of those treatment devices on the waters in the communities themselves. Have a final report on that in no later than May. The third item on the list, just our health-based value development for PFBA. We are working, Dr. Helen Gaydon is working on that, and I didn't ask her to come today because she's talking to scientists today. She's made contact and had very helpful input from two medical researchers, endocrinologists, Dr. Terry Mariash from the University of Minnesota's Endocrinology and Diabetes Center, and then Dr. Thomas Zeller, who is the head of the Lab for Molecular and Cellular Biology at University of Massachusetts. And those are two recognized experts in the field of endocrinology. One of the questions that we need to resolve that there have been some debate over is the effect of the changes in thyroid hormones on health and health status of the animals that were the subject of the studies. And so these outside experts from these two research institutions are providing responses to questions that we posed to them in terms of evaluating the data and the studies that were presented and how we should look at the results of those studies and what should be considered relevant and what may not be considered relevant. So Dr. Gaydon and those two researchers have had good conversations by phone, as well as we're getting formal input from them in writing on questions that we posed. And all of that will be a part of the decision that we make for setting a value, a health-based value for PFBA. We are on track to release a value late this month. We're planning on the 28th or the 29th of February. Since we get an extra day in February, I said maybe we should make use of that leap day for this purpose. But we will have a health-based value ready to release to the public. We're undergoing some discussion about how we might present that value, because there is ongoing research and additional information gathered and conducted in research projects continuously, that we may want to set a time frame for its effect and move to reevaluated on a very intentionally planned time frame. So we're considering that, and we'll be thinking about how we might do that. With that, I'd answer any questions on those three quick updates, and then if there are none, I can certainly bring Dr. Johnson up for the presentation on biomonitoring.
Representative Biggum?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Dr. Stein. Regarding the 28th or 29th announcement of the PFBA health-based value, if it comes in lower than what the advisory limit is, or what the contamination level is, I'm going to just say if it comes in at 1.5 parts per billion, and I have wells in my district that are over that, are you prepared when you call the city staff, public works, and city administrators, are you prepared to tell them what next? Here's what you do. Here's what we're going to do so that they're not flooded with phone calls and they're not having to deal with, you know, kind of a panic situation. And this may be more of a PCA-type question, but I know that that is a concern that I've had from staff. Like, if it comes in at one, or, you know, either 0.5 or 1.5, or, you know, that they're going to get all these calls, because they're not going to call you, even though I've given your number out quite a few times. They're still not going to call you. They're going to call City Administrator Schroeder and Barry and Larry down in Newport and Temple Park. So I guess I'm just wondering what you have planned for that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Biggum, we have met early this week. We had a meeting between the Department of Health and the Pollution Control Agency to coordinate on the timeline, what needs to be done, what information needs to be shared, and what steps will need to be taken so that we've built an adequate amount of time in to advise the local units of government and to inform the Pollution Control Agency should there be a change in the value, and the response that would be then directed towards drinking water remedies. We have given ample time, I would say. There's never enough time, but there's the time that you're going to have is to prepare the messaging that needs to go out publicly so that the communities are not overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. Although people will tend to call their community, we understand that. Mm-hmm. We're still going to work hard to inform the communities. In fact, we've worked with the communities to align ourselves with early March, the first or second week of March, additional series of public meetings, which we promised last year when we were in the communities. We promised the communities that we would be out again to meet once we had meaningful information to share about health risks and health risk information. So we are working with the communities already to set up those meetings, and I believe there will be an announcement Monday of the dates and times of those public meetings so that there will be plenty of time for the public to know that we're planning to gather, and we again will be present and will answer those questions, hopefully to take the pressure off the community officials to give them the information, how we develop the number, and what it means in terms of health risks.
No, that's
thank you, Madam Chair. Director Stein, I'm just wondering, is there a possibility, if you're going to release it February 28th or 29th, that we would be able to be briefed as a group and with the community leaders? I think that, you know, if you're going to give it out to the public, I think there'll be benefit to us to have a meeting so that, because I believe there will be an immediate rush for folks to contact us and in the local municipalities. And then I would just want to confirm again, and I'm glad to hear you're talking to a couple of the qualified scientists from Massachusetts and Minnesota. We're going to use sound science to drive the change in this number, realizing that we want to be conservative and knowing that there's multiple chemicals and things in our folks' drinking water, but we are going to use science and not something else to drive our decisions here so that we can keep a level of confidence among our constituents.
And Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, absolutely, to your last question, yes. There's I've instructed our staff to have no conversations with me, with our commissioner's office, with any elected officials or anyone other than the scientists regarding the information they will use to calculate the number, so that there isn't an influence, an undue influence of policy or implications upon community response. So we have guarded Dr. Gaydon from that possibility, and there won't be any influence. I'm quite confident of that. To your first point, yes, we do plan to meet with community leaders prior to the public announcement. We also plan on a briefing for the affected legislative representatives and senators, so that there's, as you say, an opportunity to ask questions and understand the information that we'll be presenting to the community in early March. We have also identified other groups that we need to brief, who will be asked questions and will have significant interest in the outcome.
Director Stein, if I can follow up with that, because of the free movement of information, as soon as we give it to one of those groups, are you cognizant of the fact that this needs to take place over a relatively short amount of minutes, so that we're all on the same page as we let this information out, and it doesn't get sent by one group in one direction that we spend most of our time backpedaling to try and straighten it out?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, absolutely. We're going to do it all within about 2.5 hours on one day.
Mm-hmm. Representative Wales?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Director Stein, for, once again, very enlightening testimony. And I also want to thank the Department of Health for the excellent hearing that we had in Woodbury a few weeks ago. I think the people who were in attendance there were very appreciative, and I've heard many, many comments about the superior job that you did. I just have a quick question, and that is, last winter when we were first discussing all of this, it seemed like there really was not a national standard for the HRL. And I am wondering if now, with all of the research that Minnesota has done, if you are considered now kind of the flashpoint or whatever for being able to help establish that in terms of a national dialogue, because that is what was confusing last winter. Different states at different levels.
Madam Chair, Representative Swales, that Minnesota in general on the subject of PFCs is the place that has had the most conversation, both from a pollution remediation perspective as well as the health risk information that we've developed. Mm-hmm. Dr. Gaydon and her peers in our department have presented it at national and international conferences on the subject and convened technical conversations with a scientist from the EPA, other states, as well as international governments. We would be considered to be leading, and I need to acknowledge the fact that the research activities that 3M has funded are significant toward advancing the science, and it is important that we have the research in order to looking at laboratory studies on animals to evaluate the effects of chemicals, and without 3M's ability to move quickly and fund that research, which they have done, and there has been thorough scientific scrutiny and oversight of their work, that we have been able to move ahead. Having said that, EPA's standard setting for drinking water generally takes 10 to 15 years from the point at which they identify the need for a standard, for a national standard, until one is actually promulgated, because EPA's job is different than the Minnesota Department of Health's job. EPA serves a function to evaluate the risks to population health as well as the benefits and costs to population health and the available remedies. So they look at cost-benefit analyses, they look at the health implications, and it is a very long and scrutinous process and typically takes a decade or more to arrive at a national drinking water standard. That's why you'll see for the next several years, if there are additional findings of these compounds elsewhere in drinking water, they will be generally addressed locally, not by the federal government. But the federal government has significantly increased its research activities over the past 3 to 5 years. So there is work coming.
Mm-hmm. So just a brief suggestion, Dr. Stein. I know that last January when the findings of PFCA were announced, they were announced at about 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and I happened to notice them as I left the Children's Museum and walked by the NPR sign. And I was relieved because many of us had found out about this a week before. So I truly appreciate the fact that we're all going to find out together. I would suggest that February 29th is the Friday, and that I would rather see something like this released on a Monday so that people who have questions mm-hmm. have the ability to contact their cities, their health department, because no matter how much we do, we're going to have to rely on the press to release this information if it comes out on a Friday afternoon. So mm-hmm. while I really appreciate that you're trying to do this, it would be great to be able to have time for a public. So that would be my former background as a public relations person giving you some advice.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stein, I just had a question about PFCA and Oakdale. Is Oakdale going to be included in all this? I know that it's primarily been found in the more southern areas. Could we be included, or how do you see that working?
Madam Chair and Representative Swallow, yes, we've continued to gather data on concentrations of PFCA in Oakdale's drinking water.
Okay.
We will include the value that we establish for health-based value will be applicable over the entire area. And so the remedies or the discussion of remedies that may or may not be part of whatever the number is, and I truly don't know what the number is, every community that's been affected will be included in that discussion.
I just want to underscore the Senator Saltzman comment, and I'd be willing to let you off the hook for making it early March rather than into February if it means it's a Monday. But I think that's an important point that's been made, and it would help the process, I believe. So,
thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, so we'll go on to discuss the biomonitoring program. And for the sake of time, I know there's the health tracking component as well. I think that let's... Dean, are you hearing this too? for the sake of the time constraint, let's focus primarily on the biomonitoring issue, which you've heard at community meetings, some of the questions I posed to you in the formal letter, and make sure we cover that. And if we don't get to the health tracking portion today, we'll put that off to a future time, but to focus on the biomonitoring. Okay?
That's very good.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to give you just a brief update on our pilot project that we are proposing for the East Metro area. And I did put together just a few slides. I don't know if you can see these, but I think you have them also in a handout. Essentially, where we are today with the PFC monitoring project, you might remember this diagram, which I actually presented back in, I think it was either early October or late September, the first meeting of this mm-hmm. committee, where I explained the process that we would be going through in developing protocols for these projects. And where we are currently with the PFC project, we did back in October present our draft preliminary protocol to the Science Advisory Panel at their first meeting. So that has been reviewed. We then went back to them again in December a second time and presented it again. So the panel has actually reviewed the protocol twice. But just recently we have done some work with community engagement and listening to comments from the community and getting recommendations. And that's really where we are currently. We did have, just last week, we had three community meetings, one in Cottage Grove, one in Lake Elmo, and one in Oakdale. And we heard a number of comments. And I think you have a handout that is a summary of the comments that we received. Essentially, Some of the ones that we heard, sample size was raised frequently. People want to know if 100 is a big enough sample. Eligibility criteria, and as I'm sure you're aware, we heard from folks who've been very long-time residents there that wanted to know, would the study focus specifically on long-time residents? We heard from many people that concerned about children that would like to see the project focus specifically on children, and we also heard requests that the project should focus specifically on pregnant women. As you know, what we proposed is adults ages 20 and over. But we did listen to these concerns. We also had many questions about the purpose of the project. Generally, people concerned that the scope was too narrow. This is something, obviously, we're aware of with a pilot, that the scope will be narrow. We explained to people that it's not a research study that's going to answer all the possible questions, but that the scope is narrow. People were interested in their pets. They also asked about obtaining independent samples. Could they, for example, if they obtain an independent sample and had that analyzed, could they add that to the study? People wanted to know about the time frame. Some were concerned that it would take too long. We estimate it takes about a year. Questions about credibility. Did we have a statistician, for example, and questions about the laboratory. There are many questions about water safety, which Mr. Stein's staff were there on hand to answer, and of course questions and concerns about data privacy. It is certainly our hope to work with the community to resolve as many of these questions and concerns as possible. The other thing that we presented to the community, a number of folks asked, we hear often sort of the so what question, if the only answer that we're going to provide is we're going to tell people the amount of chemical that's in their body, and we're going to compare that to the national sample, which is what we've explained to folks. People want to know, you know, what is the value of these projects? And so the way we've explained that to the community, we've talked about that in terms of benefits that we see to the individual, benefits to the community, and then benefits to the state. We do think that the project is going to provide valuable information to the individual participants who choose to participate. They will receive their results. They will receive a comparison to the national average. They'll also receive information about how to reduce exposures to TFCs, and they'll also receive the opportunity, if they have concerns about their health, to receive consultation by a physician. In the case of using to community members, we also think the project will benefit the community in the sense that community will be able to see as a whole how they compare, again, to a national sample. We'll be able to say whether or not, for example, in general, does the community of adults in Oakdale, do they look similar to the national or perhaps more than national levels? This information may help with developing recommendations for further action in the future. And then for the state, and this would include, you know, policymakers, stakeholders, we think that this project provides a great deal of information to help us plan for the future. As you know, this legislation was set up, these four pilot projects were set up specifically to help us come back in 2009 with recommendations for ongoing biomonitoring in the state. We think these pilots are very valuable for doing that. They give us some good information. Future recommendations that we may come back with in 2009 may be how to tie biomonitoring, for example, into more research, because we do hear that there is a desire to do that. We may be able to make recommendations about how to expand to additional groups, such as how do we include children, what are the best methods for doing that. There are some issues that we need to deal with to include children. We will certainly learn some of the perils and pitfalls of biomonitoring. Some of the very questions that you raised in your letter are some of the same questions that we hear debated nationally and internationally with various states and countries that are wrestling with how to do biomonitoring. We are, within our own science panel, going to be talking about developing guidelines, policy guidelines, to guide our decisions for biomonitoring. So we think these pilots are extremely valuable. We think they have brought up a number of very good questions, some of which you have raised with regards to biomonitoring, and these are all important questions that we need to be talking about as we plan and think about how to go forward with biomonitoring. And I think that is it. I did present a letter, and I'm sorry that if you just received that letter and didn't get a chance to read, but we do have the responses to those questions, so if you would like, I could go through them, or if you prefer, we could just take questions.
Well, I didn't even have the letter in front of me yet. First of all, in terms of this comparison of the results to a national baseline, which is, I assume you're referring to the NHANES on that, could you list, I assume, whether internally or externally, there are other sources of some baseline data. Could you list for us what other baseline data you might be looking at that would provide further illumination about what these numbers might mean in terms of both other general population data on CFCs in blood serum, but also occupational and other hotspot studies that have been done.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We did prepare a table, and this is attached mm-hmm. to the letter with mm-hmm. the responses.
Mm-hmm.
If we put together, or actually we sort of added to it over just the last few days in responding to your questions,
mm-hmm.
You can see the NHANES data at the mm-hmm. top. That is a national U.S. sample. That's the one that we consider to be the best mm-hmm. Reference value for the general population. Based on large sample sizes, it is a U.S. population. And you can see it's also been conducted in recent years. It's been conducted in 99, 2000, and 03, 04. Some other references that we can look at, there have been a couple of studies, Red Cross adult blood donors, that have been conducted. They published one in 2000, 2001, and I believe there are some updates mm-hmm. available of that also.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the comparison in those values. Difference, of course, being between those is the Red Cross sample would be people who choose to come and can donate blood or are eligible to donate blood. That may be a different, slightly different population than the general population captured by NHANES. Another one we looked at, because this one was mentioned actually in some emails that we received, a study looking at 598 children across 23 states. This paper was actually published in the Journal of Children's Health, and it was actually an analysis of blood samples that had been collected as part of a clinical study at the University of Minnesota. Children had been brought into this study because of Group A streptococcal infection, and so the blood samples were stored and saved from that study. So what the authors of this paper did essentially was to get those samples and run a PFC analysis on those stored samples. So we really know very little about where those came from, except that we know that they came from 23 states. And we know that blood was collected in 1994-95. You had asked specifically about international studies. We looked for what we could find internationally. As far as what's been published already, we have some of those presented, and you can see PFC analyses have been done in many countries around the world. There's one here from Australia, which you can see is based on pooled serum samples. We've also recently learned Germany, Europe in general, is doing quite a bit of biomonitoring work. Germany has an environmental survey similar to the way NHANES is conducted. They're doing something very similar to that in their population, and they have a particular focus on children also in their population. So we expect, actually they have just recently published a preliminary reference value for children based on three studies that were done in Germany. So. And that's basically what we have found as far as mm-hmm. reference values. So.
And in addition to this, this does not include what I referred to in terms of we have 3M occupational biomonitoring data that they've done for many years, and the chief investigator on that's in the room today. And then we also have, I don't know if it's available yet, but we know that some of the other sites in the United States that have had specific pollution exposures, part of legal agreements and other things, there's some biomonitoring going on, and there will be some results coming from that as well. So in addition to some general baseline data, they'll also be in existence by the time we're probably done with this. Some data from other sites that had real exposure to known contamination in water supplies as well. Would you briefly, since it was a topic in our last meeting here, but also our public health meeting in Woodbury, it was raised as well, just summarize briefly the points you make here about your decision about not to include children in this particular study at this time?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Madam Chair. Essentially, when we started this, we looked at the language in the bill, which asks us to look at a population likely to be exposed. And, of course, knowing what we know about PFCs, we know that pretty much everyone is likely to be exposed to PFCs. So we knew we had to make a choice. We had to think about, in this population, who would be most likely to have had the most exposure. And when we're looking at drinking water, we knew we were looking at exposure over many years and over a long time. So the decision was really about looking at who's had the most long-term exposure, and that really did lead us to considering adults as having had exposure, the greatest exposure in the past over time. That was certainly one and probably the initial reason and consideration. As you know, we put in our eligibility criteria also that folks who had lived at their residence after January 1, 2005 would not be eligible. This was because of all the interventions that went into place in 2005, 2006. Folks that had recently moved into the area would not have been exposed to those prior levels in the drinking water. So that actually kind of shifts the selected population more towards longer-term residents. That's the group that we thought was appropriate. We also wanted the sample to be comparable to the NHANES, knowing that this was the best reference value that was out there available to us. We didn't at the time see a reference value for children. We do anticipate in another year NHANES will probably be publishing a reference value that they're going to get using pooled children samples. But currently we do not have a good reference value for children. So that was another factor that we want it to be as comparable as possible to the NHANES so that we can make a valid comparison. And then another consideration has to do with, it's actually an ethical consideration. Generally, in public health, we don't recommend medical testing unless we can demonstrate a benefit to the child, particularly if that test carries any risk at all. And so, in other biomonitoring studies have also confronted this and started to deal with ethical questions around the testing of children. Institutional review boards consider children to be a very sensitive population. They look very hard at studies that look at children as subjects in research to be sure that any risks in those children, that there is an equal benefit for the child. And we view this as a real problem. If we wanted to do children, we knew that we would be potentially facing an ethical conflict with our institutional review board. And so our feeling is that if we do at some point decide that children are the appropriate focus, that we really need to figure out an appropriate and ethical method to look at specifically at children. I think there are ways to do it, but in this particular pilot project, we didn't feel it was appropriate. And I think those are the primary reasons. The other factor, I know there has been some who have asked, why don't we focus exclusively on folks who have lived long time in the community, 20, 30, 40 years in the community. We wanted to go down to age 20, partly because that does take in women of childbearing years. And some of those women, if they were born and raised in Oakdale, have had 20 years of exposure, and we think that's a very important group that should be included. Mm-hmm. So that's the basis for the decision.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the Health Department. This is very helpful to us. I attended the Oakdale one, and as you know, I think every question you've mentioned came up there. I mean, that I was really surprised by how upset people are. And I don't know if there's not been, obviously there's not been a lot of public meetings on this, and the first one on biomonitoring, but on the issue in general, it just seemed like people had a high level of anxiety at that meeting. Are you going to post this information anywhere? Do they get any kind of follow-up? Because these were all the questions they were asking. When you sit and read it like this, it makes a lot of sense. But that night, we're often in the hot seat, so I know what it feels like. But, boy, I I wish it could have been handled better. It would seem like, on one hand, no matter what you guys were going to say, they were going to sort of be upset. But when you very rationally lay it out, it certainly helps make the case a lot quicker. And maybe it took going through the meetings and laying it out to come to these kinds of conclusions. Are you going to get back to people with this information? They did do sign. They signed in, right?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, yes, they did sign in. And we do plan to get back. We certainly can do that. We hope to have more information on the website so that people can constantly, you know, stay updated, have progress on that. And we can certainly come back to the communities. I think that would be a very good idea.
Madam Chair, it sounds like, do you have their email addresses? Is that what you have?
We have their email addresses for two of the meetings, and I'm only smiling because actually it was at the Oakdale meeting that our sign-in list was actually disappeared when we went back to retrieve it. So we do not have the list of people from the Oakdale meeting, unfortunately.
It is unfortunate because some of them have emailed me, and they're very interested in these meetings, and they just can't seem to get enough information. And because this is their lives and their families and people they care about, and so I hope that, I suppose that won't surface, but I hope that list surfaces. But if you can post some of this on the website, and then I think from at least there's going to be more public meetings about the when the new standard is developed. So I mean, there'll be a presence back out in Oakdale.
Mm-hmm.
They posted it, and I don't know if you knew that, on all our marquees around the city.
Mm-hmm.
It's a biomonitoring meeting. You know, mm-hmm. So if you're up north off 36, it was there. It was at the city hall. So I think in some ways maybe that got people extra interested.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if we could do those types of things, and if you can talk to Oakdale about that again, then you might get a similar crowd. But I just hope they can get this information back.
Since that list is missing, possibly if you could do a commonly asked questions section, which you may already have started on your biomonitoring website, and then possibly Representative Falk or others could write a letter to their local papers or short piece saying, go to this spot to see this, so that those who attend the meeting would be aware of that.
That's a great idea. And we do know a couple people because I've had a couple of follow-ups that I could, sort of ask, but that's a great idea if we could, if you're okay with that, well, we can talk about what it would look like to go out in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Olson?
Yes. Come up. It is very helpful. Thank you so much. And, for those of us who have ever been with a very small child who's had to have a venipuncture, I appreciate the fact that I think that it's really easy to say, why aren't we studying kids? And then to be aware of, for some children, this is a very traumatic experience at a very young age, which is, I think, the child that we're looking at in this study that concerns. So thank you for providing this. I think it helps.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, whatever comes from this study may indicate there is further study needed. And that's, I think, what's very important about this background.
A couple of comments in this regard to the general topic they're on about children is the study of the multiple state study that we're aware of, that blood serum existed because of something else that they were studying, right? So they're studying streptococcal infections, I believe, and therefore they had these blood samples already. And in that case, the benefits side of your institutional review process is clearer in terms of that, they're testing them for other reasons. It's just the side use of the blood serum. So again, of course, going forward, we could look for those kinds of opportunities possibly in these communities possibly to do that kind of thing. Also, it's my understanding that one of the things you'll learn by looking at the adult data that comes from this is kind of the level of variation and statistical things about that would help you better design future studies, help you understand what sample size you really do need for answering various kinds of questions and that type of thing. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is correct. And I didn't go to my next slide, but I'll show it to you now. Since we do get a lot of questions about sample size, there are a number of factors that go into a sample size calculation. Usually when an epidemiologist designs a study, we start with the particular research question that we want to answer, and we design a study to fit that question. So we usually have to match the calculation based on what we know about variability in the data that we expect, based on what we think the difference that we're trying to measure might be. All of those factors are needed to answer the sample size calculation. So we will learn a lot from the pilot study. Just getting a sense of the variability in the data will help us to plan the future.
Is there other information from this that any of you would like to hear today discussed publicly, other than in the letter? Is that important to you? Okay. We covered most of it. On the issue of will there be enough people with long-term exposure, how are you, I have a general idea of how you're selecting people, but how is that long-term, other than, you know, not people who've moved here after a certain date, 2000, 2002, whatever, but how are you assured that you're going to get enough people who have 20 years in the community or those types of things? Like, how is that being addressed?
Madam Chair, since it's going to be a random sample of that particular group, what we would expect is we're going to get a distribution that should match the distribution in the community. Mm-hmm. If it's a truly random sample, that's what you should get. That may not happen, you know, if we know that we will have people who will refuse, and there are certain types of groups and certain age groups that will refuse to participate mm-hmm. in a survey. So it's rare that your random sample ever actually perfectly mm-hmm. reflects the community. So it's possible we will miss some long-time residents just for that factor, but we would expect them to be there in pretty much the same proportions that they are in the community. So the only way to guarantee more would be to limit, mm-hmm. like I said, to limit the sample further, but we have reasons for not wanting to do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
We actually like the idea of being able to see some variability in that residence time. That's another factor that we can look at with this pilot data to see if there is any relationship. We can try to look at that with a sample size of 100. I'm not sure, again, based on variability, whether we'll be able to see differences based on residence time, but we certainly can look at that variation.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I have a question just related to that, and it's a little bit speculative, but in Oakdale, these are the folks that have lived there a long time, very concerned about whether they themselves are being affected. You know, the issue came up about Tartan High School and a lot of incidences of cancer there and what's happening there. Do you foresee at any point where, you know, it seems what would take the anxiety down is if people could just go get tested somewhere and get their level, and then we have the lady in the audience who had gotten tested, and I mean it was right out of a novel. I mean it was real life, and so people were so worried about, really, I think what they're saying is themselves,
mm-hmm.
and they've been long-term residents. They want to know what's happening with that. They, you know, they've gone to this school and drinking this water. They want to know about that. Do you see any way we can move in that direction? Or is that a conversation for another day? Or, you know, we had the conversation about health insurance and who would cover it. And you guys have the only lab, right, that can process these kinds of requests?
Madam Chair, Representative Flood, no, I believe there are some other labs. And actually, one of the charges in our statute for our laboratory staff is to look at the issue of other labs that are qualified to do this. That's correct. But we did hear that concern also loud and clear, and we are working to try to have some answers for that.
Yeah, I would, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. I'd be very interested in that, because I think, one, we want this to be a good study, we want the results to be good, but we really want people in the interest of public health to be able just to see where they're at, and if the problem is we do have studies now we can compare to, because there was a question about that, but
mm-hmm.
If there was a way for people to sign up or get on a list or find out more information, I think it'd be very helpful. No.
I think
that's not going to go away either, if that's the other thing, once it comes out, then there's going to be another push where people are going to want to be tested
mm-hmm.
again.
Well, I think in terms of the question is, what does see where they're at mean? Because, frankly, once we have this number, other than knowing we're higher or lower than other kinds of baselines or other studies, in terms of what that means for our health, we really have no idea at this point if it means anything. We know what it means when animals at very high doses are pushed to the point where there's a health effect, you know, but we don't know at the levels we're going to find here what the short-term and long health effects are. And so that's why this is very difficult doing this type of work. We've made as a state decision to go forward this because we believe more information is better than not having information, but it also has the possibility of getting people upset and with not knowing what to do with that information. Even if they were, you know, their level was higher than some baseline, and they went to their physician and they said that, this physician wouldn't have a clue what that meant or what they should do or even necessarily what they should be tested for. So in any way, so this is the beginning stages of developing understanding, and I would expect what we learn from this will help inform, depending on what those results are, whether we need additional studies and additional studies behind bioengineering that are, health-related studies. So it will inform those future decisions and give the legislators some information to base that on. You want to comment further on that?
I would agree.
Okay. Yeah. So it's very complicated. I think as with releasing the PFDA, level number, it has to be handled very sensitively, and it's tough to do for all of us. Those doing the work and us public officials, both state and local, to how to talk about this to citizens. What value it would be to us, and what it can't do, what it can, what it can't do. It's complicated. Mm-hmm. Are we going to? Well, it's now 5:02. So, shall we save health tracking for another day?
That would be fine.
Okay. I do have one or two summary comments. Did anybody else on the panel have a comment to share at the end here? Okay. Since they're still in the room, our PCA folks. I wanted to say that I think that regarding the landfills and the disposal sites, in general, and particularly since I live in Lake Elmo, I think what we're hearing from residents of the state in a more broad sense is the state has said they would take care of this landfill. And to a citizen, that doesn't mean they will try to protect us from pollution, but that they will protect us from pollution. And they won't try to take care of the problem, but that they will take care of the problem. So it's very difficult when, in the end, on a practical level, it comes down to some very large sums of money involved, to respond to that reasonable expectation of our general public, that their public health is protected and that their drinking water is safe long term, and not only for themselves but for their children in 50 years and for their grandchildren beyond that. And we up here, and all of you, and also the taxpayers, are dealing with the issue of what all this costs. Not in this particular instance, but all the other landfills of the whole variety of waste that we have in the state of Minnesota. And no matter what the outcome is for this particular situation, this particular year, the citizens of our communities, at least from what we're hearing from them, expect that it's a primary role of government to protect them, to provide clean drinking water, and to protect them from this kind of contamination over the long run. And not just to try to, but to actually do it. And that, we need to hear that, and I think that means we need to raise larger questions about our whole approach to managing all types of waste going forward in our state and open ourselves to innovation, from wherever that might come, to try to be in the cutting edge of finding more permanent and less environmentally damaging solutions to these problems. That's really the fundamental challenge facing us all. And if that means we go on a limb and be one of the first states to, trying to find a way that plasma torch or something else could be used in an innovative way, I would hope that as a state at times we step up, and particularly with companies as innovative as 3M involved as well, technology leaders involved here, that we at least open ourselves to, some of the most cutting-edge possibilities that exist there. Now, I understand that we might find that this particular option we've been talking about today may not be that cutting-edge option we need to pursue, but I challenge us as a state and as a legislature and as an agency addressing pollution issues that we need to push ourselves to be open to that and to fund those things, if necessary, to find more permanent solutions to all of this, not just in this instance, but for all the future streams of waste all of us are going to be creating, and to find appropriate upfront ways to pay for that by, as with some of the recycling issues and electronics issues, that we pay for the appropriate permanent disposal or very long-term disposal of these things when we use that energy source or when we use that product, and that we structure our consumer purchases so that we are including in that what it will cost to appropriately take care of these wastes down the road. So I just put that out there because we get focused so much on the short term and the immediate problem we need to solve. But I think that's what the citizens of our state expect from all of us, to be in the backs of our minds as we move forward. So I thank you all for being here today, and I thank MPCA and 3M and the Department of Health for their contributions to keeping us informed and continuing to do that, and we appreciate your efforts in this area, and thank you all very much. Thank you.